barely missing another mailbox. But that was all right. The poor old guy was only doing 20 and Mountain Road was deserted. On the radio, WCIK was playing Low, Sweet Hope of Heaven, by the Blind Boys of Alabama. Alden thrust the wallet at her. There he is. There's my boy. With his grandpa. Will you drive while I look? Sammy asked. Sure. Alden took the wheel back. The truck began to move a little faster and a little straighter, although it was more or less straddling the white line. The photograph was a faded color shot of a young boy and an old man with their arms around each other. The old man was wearing a Red Sox cap and an oxygen mask. The boy had a big grin on his face.
He's a beautiful boy, sir, Sammy said.
Yeah, beautiful boy. Beautiful, smart boy. Alden let out a tearless spray of pain. He sounded like a donkey. Spittle flew from his lips. The truck plunged, then came right again.
I have a beautiful boy, too, Sammy said.
She began to cry. Once, she remembered, she had taken pleasure in torturing brats. Now she knew how it felt to be in the microwave herself, burning in the microwave.
I'm going to kiss him when I see him. Kiss him once more.
You kiss him, Alden said.
I will.
You kiss him and hug him and hold him.
I will, sir.
I'd kiss my boy if I could. I'd kiss his cold, cold cheek.
I know you would, sir.
But we buried him. This morning, right on the place.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Have another beer.
Thank you.
She had another beer. She was getting drunk. It was lovely to be drunk. In this fashion, they progressed, as the pink stars grew brighter overhead, flickering but not falling. No meteor showers tonight. They passed Sammy's trailer, where she'd never go again, without slowing. 17. It was about 7:45 when Rose Twitchell knocked on the glass panel of the Democrats' door. Julia, Pete, and Tony were standing at a long table, creating copies of the newspaper's latest four-page broadside. Pete and Tony put them together. Julia stapled them and added them to the pile. When she saw Rose, Julia waved her in energetically. Rose opened the door, then staggered a little.
Jeez, it's hot in here.
Turned off the AC to save juice, Pete Freeman said, and the copier gets hot when it's overused, which it has been tonight. But he looked proud. Rose thought they all looked proud.
Thought you'd be overwhelmed at the restaurant, Tony said.
Just the opposite. Could have shot deer in there tonight. I think a lot of people don't want to face me because my cook's been arrested for murder. And I think a lot of people don't want to face each other because of what happened at Food City this morning.
Come on over here and grab a copy of the paper, Julia said. You're a cover girl, Rose. At the top, in red, were the words free, Dome Crisis Edition, free. And below that, in 16-point type Julia had never used until the last two editions of the Democrat, riot and murders as crisis deepens. The picture was of Rose herself. She was in profile. The bullhorn was to her lips. An errant lock of hair lay on her forehead, and she looked extraordinarily beautiful. In the background was the pasta and juices aisle, with several bottles of what looked like spaghetti sauce smashed on the floor. The caption read, Quiet Riot. Rose Twitchell, owner and proprietor of Sweetbriar Rose, quells food riot with the help of Dale Barbara, who has been arrested for murder. See story below in editorial, page 4.
Holy God, Rose said. Well, at least you got my good side, if I can be said to have one.
Rose, Tony Gay said solemnly, you look like Michelle Pfeiffer. Rose snorted and flipped him the bird. She was already turning to the editorial.
Panic Now, Shame Later, by Julia Shumway. Not everybody in Chester's Mill knows Dale Barbara.
He is a relative newcomer to our town, but most people have eaten his cooking in Sweetbriar Rose. Those who do know him would have said before today that he was a real addition to the community, taking his turn at umpiring softball games in July and August, helping out with the middle school book drive in September, and picking up trash on Common Cleanup Day just 2 weeks ago. Then today, Barbie, as he is known by those who do know him, was arrested for 4 shocking murders. Murders of people who are well-known and well-loved in this town. People who, unlike Dale Barbara, have lived here most or all of their lives. Under ordinary circumstances, Barbie would have been taken to the Castle County Jail, offered his one phone call, and provided with a lawyer if he couldn't afford one. He would have been charged, and the evidence gathering, by experts who know what they are doing, would have begun. None of that has happened, and we all know why. Because of the dome that has now sealed our town off from the rest of the world. But have due process and common sense also been sealed off? No matter how shocking the crime, unproved accusations are not enough to excuse the way Dale Barbara has been treated, or to explain the new police chief's refusal to answer questions, or allow this correspondent to verify that Dale Barbara is still alive, although the father of Dorothy Sanders, First Selectman Andrew Sanders, was allowed to not only visit this uncharged prisoner, but to vilify him. "Phew," Rose said, looking up. "You're really going to print this?" Julia gestured to the stacked copies. "It's already printed. Why? Do you object?"
"No, but..."
Rose was rapidly scanning the rest of the editorial, which was very long, and increasingly pro-Barbie. It ended with an appeal for anyone with information about the crimes to come forward, and the suggestion that when the crisis ended, as it surely would, the behavior of the residents regarding these murders would be closely scrutinized not just in Maine or the United States, but all over the world.
"Aren't you afraid you'll get in trouble?"
"Freedom of the press, Rose," Pete said, sounding remarkably unsure himself.
"It's what Horace Greeley would have done," Julia said firmly, and at the sound of his name, her corgi, who had been asleep on his dog bed in the corner, looked up.
He saw Rose and came over for a pat or two, which Rose was happy to provide.
"Do you have more than what's in here?" Rose asked, tapping the editorial.
"A little," Julia said. "I'm holding it back, hoping for more. Barbie could never have done a thing like this, but I'm afraid for him just the same."
One of the cell phones scattered on the desk rang. Tony snared it. "Democrat, Gay." He listened, then held out the phone to Julia. "Colonel Cox, for you. He doesn't sound like a happy camper." Cox. Julia had forgotten all about him. She took the telephone.
"Ms. Shumway, I need to talk to Barbie and find out what sort of progress he's making in taking administrative control there."
"I don't think that will be happening anytime soon," Julia said. "He's in jail."
"Jail? Charged with what?"
"Murder, 4 counts to be exact."
"You're joking."
"Do I sound like I'm joking, Colonel?"
There was a moment of silence. She could hear many voices in the background. When Cox spoke again, his voice was low.
"Explain this."
"No, Colonel Cox, I think not. I've been writing about it for the last 2 hours, and as my mother used to say when I was a little girl, I don't chew my cabbage twice. Are you still in Maine?"
"Castle Rock. Our forward base is here."
"Then I suggest that you meet me where we met before, Motton Road. I can't give you a copy of tomorrow's Democrat, even though it's free, but I can hold it up to the dome and you can read it for yourself."
"Email it to me."
"I won't. I think email is antithetical to the newspaper business. I'm very old-fashioned that way."
"You're an irritating piece of work, dear lady."
"I may be irritating, but I'm not your dear lady."
"Tell me this, is it a frame job, something to do with Sanders and Rennie?"
"Colonel, in your experience, does a bear defecate in the woods?"
Silence.
Then he said, "I'll meet you in an hour."
"I'll be bringing company, Barbie's employer. I think you'll be interested in what she has to say."
"Fine."
Julia hung up the phone.
"Want to take a little ride with me out to the dome, Rose?" "If it'll help Barbie, sure." "We can hope, but I'm kind of thinking we're on our own here."
Julia shifted her attention to Pete and Tony.
Will you two finish stapling those? Stack them by the door and lock up when you leave. Get a good night's sleep, because tomorrow we all get to be newsboys. This paper's getting the old-school treatment. Every house in town. The close-in farms, and Eastchester, of course. Lots of new people out there, theoretically less susceptible to the Big Jim mystique.
Pete raised his eyebrows.
Our Mr. Rennie's the home team, Julia said. He's going to climb onto the stump at the emergency town meeting Thursday night and try to wind this town up like a pocket watch. The visitors get first ups, though.
She pointed at the newspapers.
Those are our first ups. If enough people read that, he'll have some tough questions to answer before he gets to speechifying. Maybe we can disrupt his rhythm a little.
Maybe a lot, if we find out who did the rock throwing at Food City, Pete said. And you know what? I think we will. I think this whole thing was put together on the fly. There's got to be loose ends.
I just hope Barbie's still alive when we start pulling them, Julia said. She looked at her watch. Come on, Rosie. Let's take a ride. You want to come, Horace?
Horace did.
18. You can let me off here, sir, Sammy said.
It was a pleasant ranch style in Eastchester. Although the house was dark, the lawn was lit, because they were now close to the dome where bright lights had been set up at the Chester's Mill Harlow town line.
Want another beer for the road, Miss Illu?
No, sir, this is the end of the road for me.
Although it wasn't. She still had to go back to town. In the yellow glow cast by the dome light, Alden Dinsmore looked 85 instead of 45. She had never seen such a sad face. Except maybe for her own, in the mirror of her hospital room before she set out on this journey. She leaned over and kissed his cheek. The stubble there prickled her lips. He put his hand to the spot and actually smiled a little.
You ought to go home now, sir. You've got a wife to think about and another boy to take care of.
I suppose you're right.
I am right.
You'll be okay?
Yes, sir.
She got out, then turned back to him.
Will you?
I'll try, he said.
Sammy slammed the door and stood at the end of the driveway watching him turn around. He went into the ditch, but it was dry, and he got out all right. He headed back toward 119, weaving at first. Then the taillight settled into a more or less straight line. He was in the middle of the road again, fucking the white line, Phil would have said. But she thought that would be okay. It was going on 8:30 now, full dark. And she didn't think he'd meet anyone. When his taillights winked out of sight, she walked up to the dark ranch house. It wasn't much compared to some of the fine old homes on Town Common Hill, but nicer than anything she'd ever had. It was nice inside, too. She had been here once with Phil, back in the days when he did nothing but sell a little weed and cook a little glass out back of the trailer for his own use. Back before he started getting his strange ideas about Jesus, and going to that crappy church, where they believed everybody was going to hell but them. Religion was where Phil's trouble had started. It had led him to Coggins, and Coggins, or someone else, had turned him into the chef. The people who had lived here weren't tweakers. Tweakers wouldn't be able to keep a house like this for long. They'd freebase the mortgage. But Jack and Myra Evans had enjoyed a little wacky tobacco from time to time, and Phil Bushy had been happy to supply it. They were nice people, and Phil had treated them nice. Back in those days, he'd still been capable of treating people nice. Myra gave them iced coffee. Sammy had been 7 or so months gone, with little Walter then, showing plenty, and Myra had asked her if she wanted a boy or a girl, not looking down her nose a bit. Jack had taken Phil into his little office den to pay him, and Phil had called to her. Hey, honey, you should get a load of this. It all seemed so long ago. She tried the front door. It was locked. She picked up one of the decorative stones that bordered Myra's flower bed and stood in front of the picture window, hefting it in her hand. After some thought, she went around back instead of throwing it. Climbing through a window would be difficult in her current condition, and even if she was able and careful, she might cut herself badly enough to interfere with the rest of her plans for the evening. Also, it was a nice house. She didn't want to vandalize it if she didn't have to. And she didn't. Jack's body had been taken away. The town was still functioning well enough for that. But no one had thought to lock the back door. Sammy walked right in. There was no generator, and it was darker than a raccoon's asshole. But there was a box of wooden matches on the kitchen stove, and the first one she lit showed her a flashlight on the kitchen table. It worked just fine. The beam illuminated what looked like a blood stain on the floor. She switched it away from that in a hurry and started for Jack Evans' office den. It was right off the living room, a cubby so small that there was really room for no more than a desk and a glass-fronted cabinet. She ran the beam of the flashlight across the desk, then raised it so that it reflected in the glassy eyes of Jack's most treasured trophy, the head of a moose he'd shot up in TR-90 3 years before. The moose head was what Phil had called her in to see. "I got the last ticket in the lottery that year," Jack had told them, "and bagged him with that." He pointed at the rifle in the cabinet. It was a fearsome-looking thing with a scope. Myra had come into the doorway, the ice rattling in her own glass of iced coffee, looking cool and pretty and amused. The kind of woman, Sammy knew, she herself would never be. "It cost far too much, but I let him have it after he promised he'd take me to Bermuda for a week next December."
"Bermuda," Sammy said now, looking at the moose head. "But she never got to go. That's too sad."
Phil, putting the envelope with the cash in it into his back pocket, had said, "Awesome rifle, but not exactly the thing for home protection."
"I've got that covered, too," Jack had replied. And although he hadn't shown Phil just how he had it covered, he'd patted the top of his desk meaningfully. "Got a couple of damn good handguns."
Phil had nodded back just as meaningfully. Sammy and Myra had exchanged a boys-will-be-boys look of perfect harmony. She still remembered how good that look had made her feel, how included. And she supposed that was part of the reason she had come here instead of trying someplace else, someplace closer to town.
She paused to chew down another Percocet, then started opening the desk drawers. They were unlocked, and so was the wooden box in the third one she tried. Inside was the late Jack Evans' extra gun. A 45 Springfield XD automatic pistol. She took it, and after a little fumbling, ejected the magazine. It was full, and there was a spare clip in the drawer. She took that one, too. Then she went back to the kitchen to find a bag to carry it in, and keys, of course, to whatever might be parked in the late Jack and Myra's garage. She had no intention of walking back to town. 19. Julia and Rose were discussing what the future might hold for their town when their present nearly ended. Would have ended, if they had met the old farm truck on Esty Bend, about a mile and a half from their destination. But Julia got through the curve in time to see that the truck was in her lane and coming at her head-on. She swung the wheel of her Prius hard left without thinking, getting into the other lane, and the two vehicles missed each other by inches. Horace, who'd been sitting on the back seat, wearing his usual expression of, "Oh boy, going for a ride, delight," tumbled to the floor with a surprised yip. It was the only sound. Neither woman screamed or even cried out. It was too quick for that. Death or serious injury passed them by in an instant and was gone. Julia swung back into her own lane, then pulled onto the soft shoulder and put her Prius in park. She looked at Rose. Rose looked back, all big eyes and open mouth. In back, Horace jumped onto the seat again and gave a single bark, as if to ask what the delay was. At the sound, both women laughed, and Rose began patting her chest above the substantial shelf of her bosom.
My heart," she said.
"Yeah," Julia said. "Mine, too. Did you see how close that was?"
Rose laughed again shakily.
"You kidding, hun? If I'd had my arm cocked out the window, that son of a bitch would have amputated my elbow."
Julia shook her head.
"Drunk, probably."
"Drunk, assuredly," Rose said, and snorted.
"Are you okay to go on?"
"Are you?" Rose asked.
"Yes," Julia said. "How about you, Horace?"
Horace barked that he had been born ready.
"A near miss rubs the bad luck off," Rose said. "That's what Granddad Twitchell used to claim." "I hope he was right," Julia said, and got rolling again.
She watched closely for oncoming headlights, but the next glow they saw was from the spots set up at the Harlow edge of the dome. They didn't see Sammy Bushy. Sammy saw them. She was standing in front of the Evans garage with the key to the Evans Malibu in her hand. When they had gone by, she raised the garage door. She had to do it by hand, and it hurt considerably, and got behind the wheel. 20. There was an alley between Burpee's department store and the Mill Gas and Grocery connecting Main Street and West Street. It was used mostly by delivery trucks. At 9:15 that night, Junior Rennie and Carter Thibodeau walked up this alley in almost perfect darkness. Carter was carrying a 5-gallon can, red with a yellow diagonal stripe on the side in one hand. "Gasoline," read the word on the stripe. In the other hand, he held a battery-powered bullhorn. This had been white, but Carter had wrapped the horn in black masking tape so it wouldn't stand out if anyone looked their way before they could fade back down the alley. Junior was wearing a backpack. His head no longer ached and his limp had all but disappeared. He was confident that his body was finally beating whatever had fucked it up. Possibly a lingering virus of some kind. You could pick up every kind of shit at college, and getting the boot for beating up that kid had probably been a blessing in disguise. At the head of the alley, they had a clear view of the Democrat. Light spilled out onto the empty sidewalk, and they could see Freeman and Gay moving around inside, carrying stacks of paper to the door, and then setting them down. The old wooden structure housing the newspaper and Julia's living quarters stood between Sanders' hometown drug and the bookstore, but was separated from both by a paved walkway on the bookstore side and an alley like the one in which he and Carter were currently lurking on the drugstore side. It was a windless night, and he thought that if his father mobilized the troops quickly enough, there would be no collateral damage. Not that he cared. If the entire east side of Main Street burned, that would be fine with Junior. Just more trouble for Dale Barbara. He could still feel those cool, assessing eyes on him. It wasn't right to be looked at that way, especially when the man doing the looking was behind bars. Fucking Barbie. I should have shot him, Junior muttered. What? Carter asked. Nothing. He wiped his forehead. Hot.
Yeah. Frankie says if this keeps on, we're all apt to end up stewed like prunes.
When are we supposed to do this? Junior shrugged sullenly. His father had told him, but he couldn't exactly remember. 10 o'clock, maybe? But what did it matter? Let those two over there burn. And if the newspaper bitch was upstairs, perhaps relaxing with her favorite dildo after a hard day, let her burn, too. More trouble for Barbie. Let's do it now, he said. You sure, bro? You see anyone on the street? Carter looked. Main Street was deserted and mostly dark. The Jennies behind the newspaper office and the drugstore were the only ones he could hear. He shrugged.
All right. Why not?
Junior undid the pack's buckles and flipped back the flap. On top were 2 pairs of light gloves. He gave 1 pair to Carter and put on the other. Beneath was a bundle wrapped in a bath towel. He opened it and set 4 empty wine bottles on the patched asphalt. At the very bottom of the pack was a tin funnel. Junior put it in one of the wine bottles and reached for the gasoline.
Better let me, bro, Carter said. Your hands are shaking.
Junior looked at them with surprise. He didn't feel shaky, but yes, they were trembling.
I'm not afraid, if that's what you're thinking.
Never said you were. It ain't a head problem. Anybody can see that. You need to go to Everett because you got something wrong with you and he's the closest thing we got to a doctor right now.
I feel fat.
Shut up before someone hears you. Do the fucking towel while I do this.
Junior took his gun from his holster and shot Carter in the eye. His head exploded, blood and brains everywhere. Then Junior stood over him, shooting him again and again and again.
Jones.
Junior shook his head to clear away this vision.
So vivid it was hallucinatory.
And realized his hand was actually gripping the butt of his pistol.
Maybe that virus wasn't quite out of his system yet.
And maybe it wasn't a virus after all.
What, then? What?
The fragrant odor of gas smacked his nostrils hard enough to make his eyes burn. Carter had begun filling the first bottle. Glug, glug, glug went the gas can. Junior unzipped the side pocket of the backpack and brought out a pair of his mother's sewing scissors. He used them to cut 4 strips from the towel.
He stuffed one into the first bottle, then pulled it out, and stuck the other end inside, letting a length of gasoline-soaked terry cloth hang. He repeated the process with the others. His hands weren't shaking too badly for that. 21. Barbie's Colonel Cox had changed from the last time Julia had seen him. He had a good shave for going on 9:30, and his hair was combed, but his khakis had lost their neat press, and tonight his poplin jacket seemed to be bagging on him as if he'd lost weight. He was standing in front of a few smudges of spray paint left over from the unsuccessful acid experiment, and he was frowning at the bracket shape, like he thought he could walk through it if he only concentrated hard enough. "Close your eyes and click your heels 3 times, Julia thought, because there's no place like Dome. She introduced Rose to Cox and Cox to Rose. During their brief getting-to-know-you exchange, Julia looked around, not liking what she saw. The lights were still in place, shining at the sky as if signaling a glitzy Hollywood premiere, and there was a purring generator to run them. But the trucks were gone, and so was the big green HQ tent that had been erected 40 or 50 yards down the road. A patch of flattened grass marked the place where it had been. There were 2 soldiers with Cox, but they had the not-ready-for-primetime look she associated with aides or attachés. The sentries probably weren't gone, but they had been moved back, establishing a perimeter beyond hailing distance of any poor slobs who might wander up on the mill side to ask what was going on. "Ask now, plead later," Julia thought.
"Fill me in, Miss Shumway," Cox said.
"First, answer a question."
He rolled his eyes. She thought she would have slapped him for that if she'd been able to get at him. Her nerves were still jangled from the near miss on the ride out here. But he told her to ask away.
"Have we been abandoned?"
"Absolutely not,"
he replied promptly, but didn't quite meet her eye. She thought that was a worse sign than the queerly empty look she now saw on his side of the dome, as if there had been a circus, but it had moved on.
"Read this," she said,
and plastered the front page of tomorrow's paper against the dome's unseen surface, like a woman mounting a sale notice in a department store window. There was a faint, fugitive thrum in her fingers, like the kind of static shock you could get from touching metal on a cold winter morning when the air was dry. After that, nothing. He read the entire paper, telling her when to turn the pages. It took him 10 minutes. When he finished, she said,
"As you probably noticed, ad space is way down, but I flatter myself the quality of the writing has gone up. Fuckery seems to bring out the best in me."
"Miss Shumway."
"Oh, why not call me Julia? We're practically old pals."
"Fine. You're Julia and I'm JC."
"I'll try not to confuse you with the one who walked on water."
"You believe this fellow Rennie's setting himself up as a dictator, a kind of Down East Manuel Noriega?"
"It's the progression to Pol Pot I'm worried about."
"Do you think that's possible?"
2 days ago, I would have laughed at the idea. He's a used car salesman when he isn't running selectmen's meetings. But 2 days ago, we hadn't had a food riot. Nor do we know about these murders." "Not Barbie," Rose said, shaking her head with stubborn weariness. "Never."
Cox took no notice of this, not because he was ignoring Rose, Julia felt, but because he thought the idea was too ridiculous to warrant any attention. It warmed her toward him, at least a little.
"Do you think Rennie committed the murders, Julia?"
"I've been thinking about that. Everything he's done since the dome appeared, from shutting down alcohol sales to appointing a complete dope as police chief, has been political, aimed at increasing his own clout."
"Are you saying murder isn't in his repertoire?"
"Not necessarily. When his wife passed, there were rumors that he might have helped her along. I don't say they were true, but for rumors like that to start in the first place says something about how people see the man in question."
Cox grunted agreement.
"But for the life of me, I can't see how murdering and sexually abusing 2 teenage girls could be political." "Barbie would never," Rose said again. "The same with Coggins. Although that ministry of his, especially the radio station part, is suspiciously well endowed. Brenda Perkins, now, that could have been political." "And you can't send in the Marines to stop him, can you?" Rose asked. "All you guys can do is watch, like kids looking into an aquarium where the biggest fish takes all the food, then starts eating the little ones."
"I can kill the cellular service,"
Cox mused. Also internet. I can do that much.
The police have walkie-talkies, Julia said. He'll switch to those. And at the meeting on Thursday night, when people complain about losing their links to the outside world, he'll blame you.
We were planning a press conference on Friday. I could pull the plug on that.
Julia grew cold at the thought.
Don't you dare. Then he wouldn't have to explain himself to the outside world.
Plus, Rose said, if you kill the phones and the internet, no one can tell you or anyone else what he's doing.
Cox stood quiet for a moment, looking at the ground. Then he raised his head.
What about this hypothetical generator that's maintaining the dome? Any luck?
Julia wasn't sure she wanted to tell Cox that they had put a middle school kid in charge of hunting for it. As it turned out, she didn't have to, because that was when the town fire whistle went off. 22. Pete Freeman dropped the last stack of papers by the door, then he straightened up, put his hands in the small of his back, and stretched his spine. Tony Gay heard the crackle all the way across the room.
That sounds like it hurt. Nope. Feels good.
My wife will be in the sack by now, Tony said, and I've got a bottle rat-holed in my garage. Want to come by for a nip on your way home?
No. I think I'll just...
Pete began. And that was when the first bottle crashed through the window. He saw the flaming wick from the corner of his eye and took a step backward. Only one, but it saved him from being seriously burned, perhaps even cooked alive. The window and the bottle both shattered. The gasoline ignited and flared in a bright manta shape. Pete simultaneously ducked and pivoted from the hips. The fire manta flew past him, igniting one sleeve of his shirt before landing on the carpet in front of Julia's desk.
What the fuck?
Tony began, and then another bottle came arcing through the hole. This one smashed on top of Julia's desk and rolled across it, spreading fire among the papers littered there and dripping more fire down the front. The smell of burning gas was hot and rich. Pete ran for the water cooler in the corner, beating the sleeve of his shirt against his side. He lifted the water bottle awkwardly against his middle, then held his flaming shirt. The arm beneath now felt as if it were developing a bad sunburn. Under the bottle's spouting mouth. Another Molotov cocktail flew out of the night. It fell short, shattering on the sidewalk and lighting a small bonfire on the concrete. Tendrils of flaming gasoline ran into the gutter and went out.
Dump the water on the carpet! Tony shouted. Dump it before the whole place catches fire!
Pete only looked at him, dazed and panting. The water in the cooler bottle continued to gush onto a part of the carpet that did not, unfortunately, need wetting. Although his sports reporting was always going to be strictly junior varsity, Tony Gay had been a three-letter man in high school. 10 years later, his reflexes were still mostly intact. He snatched the spouting cooler bottle from Pete and held it first over the top of Julia's desk, and then over the carpet blaze. The fire was already spreading, but maybe, if he was quick, and if there was another bottle or two in the hallway leading to the supply closet.
More!
He shouted at Pete, who was gaping at the smoking remains of his shirt sleeve.
Back hall!
For a moment, Pete didn't seem to understand. Then he got it and booked for the hall. Tony stepped around Julia's desk, letting the last pint or two of water fall in the flames, trying to get a foothold there. Then the final Molotov cocktail came flying out of the dark, and that was the one that really did the damage. It made a direct hit on the stacks of newspapers the men had placed near the front door. Burning gasoline ran beneath the baseboard at the front of the office and leaped up. Seen through the flames, Main Street was a wavering mirage. On the far side of the mirage across the street, Tony could see two dim figures. The rising heat made them look like they were dancing.
"Free Dale Barbara, or this is just the beginning," an amplified voice bellowed. "There are plenty of us, and we'll firebomb the whole damn town. Free Dale Barbara, or pay the price."
Tony looked down and saw a hot creek of fire run between his feet. He had no more water with which to put it out. Soon it would finish eating through the carpet and taste the old dry wood beneath. Meanwhile, the whole front of the office was now involved. Tony dropped the empty cooler bottle and stepped back. The heat was already intense. He could feel it stretching his skin. If not for the goddamn newspapers, I might have... But it was too late for might haves. He turned and saw Pete standing in the doorway from the back hall with another bottle of Poland Spring in his arms. Most of his charred shirt sleeve had dropped away. The skin beneath was bright red.
"Too late!" Tony shouted.
He gave Julia's desk, which was now a pillar of fire shooting all the way to the ceiling, a wide berth, raising one arm to shield his face from the heat.
"Too late! Out the back!"
Pete Freeman needed no further urging. He heaved the bottle at the growing fire and ran.
23.
Carrie Carver rarely had anything to do with mill gas and grocery. Although the little convenience store had made her and her husband a pretty good living over the years, she saw herself as above all that. But when Johnny suggested they might go down in the van and take the remaining canned goods up to the house for safekeeping, was the delicate way he put it, she had agreed at once. And although she was ordinarily not much of a worker, watching Judge Judy was more her speed, she had volunteered to help. She hadn't been at Food City, but when she'd gone down later to inspect the damage with her friend Leah Anderson, the shattered windows and the blood still on the pavement had frightened her badly. Those things had frightened her for the future. Johnny lugged out the cartons of soups, stews, beans, and sauces. Carrie stowed them in the bed of their Dodge Ram. They were about halfway through the job when fire bloomed downstreet. They both heard the amplified voice. Carrie thought she saw two or three figures running down the alley beside Burpee's, but wasn't sure. Later on, she would be sure, and would up the number of shadowy figures to at least four. Probably five.
"What does it mean?"
she asked.
"Honey, what does it mean?"
"Now the goddamn murdering bastard isn't on his own," Johnny said. "It means he's got a gang." Carrie's hand was on his arm, and now she dug in with her nails. Johnny freed his arm and ran for the police station, yelling "fire" at the top of his lungs. Instead of following, Carrie Carver continued loading the truck. She was more frightened of the future than ever. 24. In addition to Roger Killian and the Bowie brothers, there were 10 new officers from what was now the Chester's Mill Hometown Security Force sitting on the bleachers of the middle school gymnasium. And Big Jim had only gotten started on his speech about what a responsibility they had when the fire whistle went off. "The boy's early," he thought. "I can't trust him to save my soul. Never could. But now he's that much worse."
"Well, boys," he said, directing his attention particularly to young Mickey Wardlaw. God, what a bruiser. "I had a lot more to say, but it seems we've got ourselves a little more excitement. Fern Bowie, do you happen to know if we have any Indian pumps in the FD barn?"
Fern said he'd had a peek into the fire barn earlier that evening just to see what sort of equipment there might be, and there were almost a dozen Indian pumps, all full of water, too, which was convenient. Big Jim, thinking that sarcasm should be reserved for those bright enough to understand what it was, said it was the good Lord looking out for them. He also said that if it was more than a false alarm, he would take charge with Stuart Bowie as his second in command. "There, you nosy Parker witch," he thought, as the new officers, looking bright-eyed and eager, rose from the bleachers. "Let's see how you like getting in my business now."
25. "Where you going?" Carter asked. He had driven his car with the lights off down to where West Street teed into Route 117. The building that stood here was a Texaco station that had closed up in 2007. It was close to town but offered good cover, which made it convenient. Back the way they had come, the fire whistle was honking six licks to a dozen, and the first light of the fire, more pink than orange, was rising in the sky.
"Huh?"
Junior was looking at the strengthening glow. It made him feel horny. It made him wish he still had a girlfriend.
"I asked you where you're going. Your dad set the alibi up."
"I left Unit 2 behind the post office,"
Junior said, taking his eyes reluctantly away from the fire.
"Me and Freddy Denton's together, and he'll say we were together all night. I can cut across from here. Might go back by West Street. Get a look at how it's catching on."
He uttered a high-pitched giggle, almost a girl's giggle, that caused Carter to look at him strangely.
Don't look too long. Arsonists are always getting caught by going back to look at their fires. I saw that in America's Most Wanted.
Nobody's wearing the golden sombrero for this motherfucker except Barbie, Junior said. What about you? Where are you going?
Home. Ma'll say I was there all night. I'll get her to change the bandage on my shoulder. Fucking dog bite. Hurts like a bastard. Take some aspirin, then come on down, help fight the fire.
They've got heavier dope than aspirin at the health center and the hospital. Also, the drugstore. We ought to look into that shit.
No doubt, Carter said.
Or, do you tweak? I think I can get some of that.
Meth? Never mess with it. But I wouldn't mind some oxy.
Oxy! Junior exclaimed.
Why had he never thought of that? It would probably fix his headaches a lot better than Zomig or Imitrex.
Yeah, bro. You talk about it.
He raised his fist. Carter bumped it, but he had no intention of getting high with Junior. Junior was weird now.
Better get going, Jones.
I'm taillights.
Junior opened the door and walked away, still limping a little. Carter was surprised at how relieved he was when Junior was gone. 26. Barbie woke to the sound of the fire whistle and saw Melvin Searles standing outside his cell. The boy's fly was unzipped, and he was holding his considerable cock in his hand. When he saw he had Barbie's attention, he began to piss. His goal was clearly to reach the bunk. He couldn't quite make it and settled for a splattery letter S on the concrete instead.
Go on, Bobby, drink up, he said. You gotta be thirsty. It's a little salty, but what the fuck?
What's burning?
As if you didn't know, Mel said, smiling.
He was still pale. He must have lost a fair amount of blood, but the bandage around his head was crisp and unstained.
Pretend I don't.
Your pals burned down the newspaper, Mel said, and now his smile showed his teeth. Barbie realized the kid was furious. Frightened, too.
Trying to scare us into letting you out. But we don't scare.
Why would I burn down the newspaper? Why not the town hall? And who are these pals of mine supposed to be? Mel was tucking his cock back into his pants.
You won't be thirsty tomorrow, Barbie. Don't worry about that. We've got a whole bucket of water with your name on it and a sponge to go with it.
Barbie was silent.
You seen that waterboarding shit in Iraq?
Mel nodded as if he knew Barbie had.
Now you'll get to experience it firsthand.
He pointed a finger through the bars.
We're gonna find out who your confederates are, fuckwad. And we're gonna find out what you did to lock this town up in the first place. That waterboarding shit? Nobody stands up to that.
He started away, then turned back. Not fresh water either. Salt, first thing. You think about it. Mel left, clumping up the basement hallway with his bandage head lowered. Barbie sat on the bunk, looked at the drying snake of Mel's urine on the floor, and listened to the fire whistle. He thought of the girl in the pick-em-up. The blondie who almost gave him a ride and then changed her mind. He closed his eyes.
Ashes. 1. Rusty was standing in the turnaround in front of the hospital, watching the flames rise from somewhere on Main Street, when the cell phone clipped to his belt played its little song. Twitch and Gina were with him, Gina holding Twitch's arm as if for protection. Ginny Tomlinson and Harriet Bigelow were both sleeping in the staff lounge. The old fellow who had volunteered, Thurston Marshall, was making medication rounds. He had turned out to be surprisingly good. The lights and the equipment were back on, and for the time being, things were on an even keel. Until the fire whistle went off, Rusty had actually dared to feel good. He saw Linda on the screen and said, "Hun, everything okay?"
"Here, yes, kids are asleep."
"Do you know what's bur-"
"The newspaper office. Be quiet and listen, because I'm turning my phone off in about a minute and a half, so nobody can call me in to help fight the fire. Jackie's here. She'll watch the kids. You need to meet me at the funeral home. Stacy Morgan will be there, too. She came by earlier. She's with us.
The name, while familiar, did not immediately call up a face in Rusty's mind. And what resonated was, she's with us. There really were starting to be sides. Starting to be with us and with them.
Lynn, meet me there 10 minutes. It's safe as long as they're fighting the fire because the Bowie brothers are on the crew. Stacy says so.
How did they get a crew together so fa-
I don't know and don't care. Can you come?
Yes.
Good. Don't use the parking lot on the side. Go around back to the smaller one.
Then the voice was gone.
What's on fire? Gina asked. Do you know?
No, Rusty said. Because nobody called. He looked at them both, and hard. Gina didn't follow, but Twitch did. Nobody at all. I just took off, probably on a call, but you don't know where. I didn't say, right? Gina still looked puzzled, but nodded. Because now these people were her people. She did not question the fact. Why would she? She was only 17. Us and them, Rusty thought. Bad medicine, usually. Especially for 17-year-olds.
Probably on a call, she said. We don't know where.
Nope, Twitch agreed. You grasshopper, we lowly ants. Don't make a big deal of it, either of you, Rusty said.
But it was a big deal. He knew that already. It was trouble.
Gina wasn't the only kid in the picture. He and Linda had a pair, now fast asleep, and with no knowledge that Mom and Dad might be sailing into a storm much too big for their little boat.
And still...
I'll be back, Rusty said, and hope that wasn't just wishful thinking.
2. Sammy Bushy drove the Evans' Malibu down Catherine Russell Drive not long after Rusty headed for the Bowie funeral parlor. They passed each other going in opposite directions on Town Common Hill. Twitch and Gina had gone back inside and the turnaround in front of the hospital's main doors was deserted. But she didn't stop there. Having a gun on the seat beside you made you wary. Phil would have said paranoid. She drove around back instead and parked in the employee's lot. She grabbed the .45, pushed it into the waistband of her jeans, and bloused her t-shirt over it. She walked across the lot and stopped at the laundry room door, reading the sign that said, "Smoking here will be banned as of January 1st. She looked at the doorknob and knew that if it didn't turn, she'd give this up. It would be a sign from God. If, on the other hand, the door was unlocked.
It was. She slipped in, a pale and limping ghost.
3.
Thurston Marshall was tired, exhausted, more like it, but happier than he had been in years. It was undoubtedly perverse. He was a tenured professor, a published poet, the editor of a prestigious literary magazine. He had a gorgeous young woman to share his bed, one who was smart and thought he was wonderful. That giving pills, slapping on salve, and emptying bedpans, not to mention wiping up the Bushy kid's beshitted bottom an hour ago, would make him happier than those things almost had to be perverse. And yet, there it was. The hospital corridors with their smells of disinfectant and floor polish connected him with his youth. The memories had been very clear tonight. From the pervasive aroma of patchouli oil in David Perna's apartment, to the paisley headband Thurst had worn to the candlelight memorial service for Bobby Kennedy. He went his rounds humming Big Leg Woman very softly under his breath. He peeped in the lounge and saw the nurse with the busted schnoz and the pretty little nurse's aide, Harriet, her name was, asleep on the cots that had been dragged in there. The couch was vacant, and soon he'd either catch a few hours' rack time on it or go back to the house on Highland Avenue that was now home. Probably back there. Strange developments. Strange world. First, though, one more check of what he was already thinking of as his patients. It wouldn't take long in this postage stamp of a hospital. Most of the rooms were empty anyway. Bill Allnut, who'd been forced to stay awake until 9 because of the injury he'd suffered in the Food City melee, was now fast asleep and snoring. Turned on his side to take the pressure off the long laceration at the back of his head. Wanda Crumley was 2 doors down. The heart monitor was beeping and her BP was a little better, but she was on 5 liters of oxygen and Thirst feared she was a lost cause. Too much weight, too many cigarettes. Her husband and youngest daughter were sitting with her. Thirst gave Wendell Crumley a V for victory, which had been the peace sign in his salad days, and Wendell, smiling gamely, gave it back. Tansy Freeman, the appendectomy, was reading a magazine. "What's the fire whistle blowing for?" she asked him.
"Don't know, hon. How's your pain?"
Three, she said matter-of-factly. "Maybe a two. Can I still go home tomorrow?"
"It's up to Dr. Rusty, but my crystal ball says yes."
And the way her face lit up at that made him feel, for no reason he could understand, like crying. "That baby's mom is back," Tansy said. "I saw her go by."
"Good,"
Thirst said. Although the baby hadn't been much of a problem. He had cried once or twice, but mostly he slept, ate, or lay in his crib, staring apathetically up at the ceiling. His name was Walter. Thirst had no idea the little preceding it on the door card was an actual name, but Thurston Marshall thought of him as the Thorazine kid. Now he opened the door of room 23, the one with the yellow baby on board sign attached to it with a plastic sucker, and saw that the young woman, a rape victim, Gina had whispered to him, was sitting in the chair beside the bed. She had the baby in her lap and was feeding him a bottle.
"Are you all right?" Thirst glanced at the other name on the door card. "Ms. Boucher?"
He pronounced it Boucher, but Sammy didn't bother to correct him. Or to tell him that boys had called her Bushy the Tushy.
"Yes, doctor,"
she said. Nor did Thirst bother to correct her misapprehension. That undefined joy, the kind that comes with tears hidden in it, swelled a little more. When he thought of how close he'd come to not volunteering, if Caro hadn't encouraged him, he would have missed this.
"Dr. Rusty will be glad you're back, and so is Walter. Do you need any pain medication?"
"No."
This was true. Her private still ached and throbbed, but that was far away. She felt as if she were floating above herself, tethered to earth by the thinnest of strings.
"Good. That means you're getting better."
"Yes," Sammy said. "Soon I'll be well."
"When you finish feeding him, climb on into the bed, why don't you? Dr. Rusty will be in to check on you in the morning."
"All right."
"Good night, Miss Boucher."
"Good night, doctor."
Thirst closed the door softly and continued down the hall. At the end of the corridor was the Rue girl's room. One peek in there, and then he'd call it a night. She was glassy but awake. The young man who'd been visiting her was not. He sat in the corner, snoozing in the room's only chair with a sports magazine on his lap, and his long legs sprawled out in front of him. Georgia beckoned Thirst, and when he bent over her, she whispered something. Because of the low voice and her broken, mostly toothless mouth, he only got a word or two. He leaned closer.
"Don't wake him."
To Thirst, she sounded like Homer Simpson.
"He the only one who came to visit me."
Thirst nodded. Visiting hours were long over, of course, and given his blue shirt and his sidearm, the young man would probably be gigged for not responding to the fire whistle, but still, what harm? One firefighter more or less probably wouldn't make any difference. And if the guy was too far under for the sound of the whistle to wake him, he probably wouldn't be much help anyway. Thirst put a finger to his lips and blew the young woman a shh to show they were conspirators. She tried to smile, then winced. Thurston didn't offer her pain medication in spite of that. According to the chart at the end of the bed, she was maxed until 2 a.m. Instead, he just went out, closed the door softly behind him, and walked back down the sleeping hallway. He didn't notice that the door to the baby on board room was once more ajar. The couch in the lounge called to him seductively as he went by, but Thurston had decided to go back to Highland Avenue after all and check the kids. 4. Sammy sat by the bed with little Walter in her lap until the new doctor went by. Then she kissed her son on both cheeks and the mouth.
"You be a good baby," she said. "Mama's going to see you in heaven, if they let her in. I think they will. She's done her time in hell."
She laid him in his crib, then opened the drawer of the bed table. She had put the gun inside so little Walter wouldn't feel it poking into him while she held him and fed him for the last time. Now she took it out. 5. Lower Main Street was blocked off by nose-to-nose police cars with their jackpot lights flashing. A crowd, silent and unexcited, almost sullen, stood behind them, watching. Horace the Corgi was ordinarily a quiet dog, limiting his vocal repertoire to a volley of welcome home barks or the occasional yap to remind Julia he was still present and accounted for. But when she pulled over to the curb by Maison de Fleur, he let out a low howl from the back seat. Julia reached back blindly to stroke his head, taking comfort as much as giving it.
"Julia, my God," Rose said.
They got out. Julia's original intention was to leave Horace behind, but when he uttered another of those small, bereft howls, as if he knew, as if he really knew, she fished under the passenger seat for his leash, opened the rear door for him to jump out, and then clipped the leash to his collar. She grabbed her personal camera, a pocket-sized Casio, from the seat pocket before closing the door. They pushed through the crowd of bystanders on the sidewalk, Horace leading the way, straining at his leash. Piper Libby's cousin, Roop, a part-time cop who'd come to the mill 5 years ago, tried to stop them. "No one beyond this point, ladies."
"That's my place," Julia said. "Up top is everything I own in the world, clothes, books, personal possessions, the lot. Underneath is the newspaper my great-grandfather started. It's only missed 4 press dates in over 120 years. Now it's going up in smoke. If you want to stop me from watching it happen at close range, you'll have to shoot me."
Roop looked unsure, but when she started forward again, Horace now at her knee and looking up at the balding man mistrustfully, Roop stood aside, but only momentarily. "Not you," he told Rose.
"Yes, me. Unless you want X-Lax in the next chocolate frap you order."
"Ma'am, Rose, I have my orders."
"Devil take your orders," Julia said, with more weariness than defiance.
She took Rose by the arm and led her down the sidewalk, stopping only when she felt the shimmer against her face rise from preheat to bake. The Democrat was an inferno. The dozen or so cops weren't even trying to put it up, but they had plenty of Indian pumps, some still bearing stickers she could read easily in the firelight, another Burpee's Sale Days special. And they were wetting down the drugstore and the bookstore. Given the windless conditions, Julia thought they might save both, and thus the rest of the business buildings on the east side of Maine.
"Wonderful that they turned out so quick," Rose said.
Julia said nothing, only watched the flames whooshing up into the dark, blotting out the pink stars. She was too shocked to cry. "Everything," she thought. "Everything." Then she remembered the one bundle of newspapers she had tossed in her trunk before leaving to meet with Cox, and amended that to "almost everything." Pete Freeman pushed through the ring of police who were currently dousing the front and north side of Sanders' hometown drug. The only clean spots on his face were where tears had cut through the soot.
"Julie, I'm so sorry." He was nearly wailing. "We almost had it stopped, would have had it stopped, but then the last bottle, the bastards threw, landed on the papers by the door and..."
He wiped his remaining shirt sleeve across his face, smearing the soot there.
"I'm so goddamn sorry."
She took him in her arms as if he were a baby, although Pete was 6 inches taller and outweighed her by 100 pounds. She hugged him, trying to mind his hurt arm, and said,
"What happened?"
"Firebombs," he sobbed. "That fucking Barbara."
"He's in jail, Pete."
"His friends, his goddamn friends, they did it."
"What? You saw them?"
"Heard 'em," he said, pulling back to look at her. "Would have been hard not to. They had a bullhorn, said if Dale Barbara wasn't freed, they'd burn the whole town."
He grinned bitterly.
"Free him? We ought to hang him. Give me a rope and I'll do it myself."
Big Jim came strolling up. The fire painted his cheeks orange. His eyes glittered. His smile was so wide that it stretched almost to his earlobes.
"How do you like your friend Barbie now, Julia?"
Julia stepped toward him, and there must have been something on her face because Big Jim fell back a step. as if afraid she might take a swing at him.
This makes no sense. None. And you know it,